Al, can't you? Can't you, if you crane your neck? Can't you hear me? Well, I'll go back out on the stage a minute anyway. Well, can I welcome everyone back anyway for the beginning of the new term and just say a bit about these lectures? I understand almost everyone in the LSE has stopped lecturing, but I'm going to go on with these lectures for three lectures, including this one. But next week's lecture, could I just emphasize, is not on a Wednesday. It's again got to be on a Tuesday, because I've got to speak in the LSE open day on the Wednesday. So it'll be at the same time, 1 o'clock, but on Tuesday next week, and then back to Wednesday for the following week. Maybe I better go up the steps because it seems to boom a bit down there, that microphone. So this lecture plus two other lectures, next one on Tuesday, final one on Wednesday, but I wish everyone a very good and happy term in spite of the proximity of the examinations. Now, I don't know if you can remember what I was talking about last term, but if you remember right back, probably nobody will, to the first lecture I gave, I defined the world in which we live, that is the late 20th century world, as a world which has taken us by surprise. That is, here we are, perched at the end of the 20th century. The directions of change which are happening in the world, the implications of the changes we're experiencing, to me anyway, don't fit the parameters which the major thinkers of modernity, the main thinkers underlying enlightenment, anticipated. Very few people anticipated the collapse of communism. Very few people foresaw, I think, that at the end of the century we'd be living essentially in a global business civilization. I don't think many people would have anticipated this to be the case. It's certainly, I think, true that the world in which we live, it does not look like that anticipated either by Marx or Max Weber. It would have taken both of those by surprise as well, I think. Now, underlying the rise of modernity, underlying the ideology of the Enlightenment, there was quite a simple precept, which I also mentioned in the very first lecture, if I remember, which I tried to argue last term, in different ways was fundamental to the writings both of Marx and Max Weber, and indeed to most of the prime theorists of modernity. The precept was, the more we get to know about the world, the more we can understand the world and shape it to human purposes. That precept being applied both to human history and to our encounters with nature. As Marx argued so forcefully, if we break with our past through understanding our history, we can control our future. If we apply rational understanding to the world of nature, we can control nature and subordinate it to the path of human history, which we'll then be the masters of. For Marx, remember, we understand history in order to make history consciously, and Marx thought that the Enlightenment period, the abandoning of religion, dogma, the abandoning of the whole of the past, was the condition of creating a rational society. In this sense, a strong connection between Hegel and Marx, which I suggested. Now, I think the experience of the late 20th century world is not like that. The experience of the late 20th century world is not a world subject to our own mastery. I think the experience of our world is much more akin to what sometimes labeled, following Edmund Leach, the Cambridge anthropologist, a runaway world. Edmund Leach gave the Reith lectures about 25 years ago They were entitled A Runaway World? I think we, in a way, take away the question mark. The late 20th century world has an erratic feel to it. The future has an opaque feel to it. The sense of a world spinning beyond our control, I would say on the whole, tends to be the dominant late 20th century feeling. It doesn't conform, certainly, as we all know, to the world foresaw by Marx, but it surely also doesn't conform to the world as diagnosed by Max Weber either. Max Weber, as I tried to show, was a much more somber interpreter of modernity. Max Weber argued that modernity imprisons us in an iron cage of bureaucratic reason and technical control. But if the Weberian view of the world were right, we would all feel like small cogs in a well-oiled, cleanly functioning, technological, bureaucratic machine. Now, of course, we do all feel like that sometimes, and that is true of parts of the social and economic world. But I think it's not true of the dominant sectors of our experience. If it ever was true, it isn't anymore. The advance of bureaucracy is not a single advance towards what one thinker once called the bureaucratization of the world. The world isn't like that. The growth of technical reason, machine technology, our intersections with nature, produce as many uncertainties as they do certainties. You don't have a well-oiled technological machine here either. So neither the world as envisaged by Marx nor the world as envisaged by Weber as a critic of Marx, really, I think, they only capture part of the late 20th century experience, and we have to ask why. Now, there's something much more interesting going on here than just that modernity, science and technology have not advanced far enough. Of course, the Enlightenment-style explanation for the somewhat puzzling nature of the late 20th century world would be, give us more science, give us more technology, give us more knowledge. The advance of knowledge will occupy those areas where ignorance prevails, and we can create a more certain sense of our own future and our own mastery. I don't think this will do. The interesting thing, I think, about the runaway world is that it hasn't come about because of a lack of human knowledge. It's come about, at least in part, by the very accumulation of human knowledge, whether that knowledge be about ourselves as individuals, whether it be about human history, or whether it be about the external world. The interesting and puzzling thing about our world is that the accumulation of knowledge has in some sense created uncertainty rather than created the secure sense of ourselves, our identities, our history and our future, which the Enlightenment sought. I won't say it's created completely the opposite, but somehow, in a way we have to puzzle through, the advance of science, technology and rational understanding of our own history is somehow deeply involved with the spinning uncertainties which we feel. You cannot, I think, develop a cogent understanding of the late 20th century world without puzzling through the implications of this statement. Now, I think the best way to do so, or a way in which I've tried to do so in various writings, is by connecting the theme of late modernity, or the experience of our world now, with conceptions of uncertainty and particularly risk. And in this lecture, I'd like to spend a certain amount of time discussing why I think the notion of risk has emerged as a fundamental notion for us and what the implications of this are for the social sciences. Basically, I'll be arguing there's a shift in the nature of risk, but at the same time, the concept of risk, whether we know it or not, enters more and more centrally into our lives, and there is a reason for this. The reason for this is very much bound up with the disappearance or the flawed nature of the hopes which Marx and other Enlightenment style thinkers projected for our future. Now, the idea of risk is a really interesting one, and I'd just like to mention a few features about it. Most cultures don't appear to have a concept of risk at all. The European word risk doesn't seem to translate into the languages of most traditional cultures, so far as we know, certainly as far as I know. There was no word for risk in the Middle Ages. The concept of risk, like so many other concepts which we tend to think have been around forever because, in a certain sense, the phenomena which they label been around forever is actually a relatively recent invention in historical terms. There's some dispute about where the notion of risk came from, but I think most widely held view is that the notion of risk originated in the original voyages of the Europeans who crossed the world exploring new continents from roughly the 15th, 16th centuries onwards. The word risk seems to originate towards the end of the 16th, beginning of the 17th century. And its first meaning seems to have been, to refer to dangerous waters. When the intrepid sailors, sailed off around the world into places, they thought they might fall off the edge of the world after all. It's a pretty brave thing to do. They sailed off there. The term risk meant unknown waters. It meant encountering hazards that hadn't been encountered before. From there, therefore, the early notion of risk seems to be a sort of quasi-geographical one. There's an important aspect of this, which I'll come back to in a sec or so. From there, the term risk enters into economic thinking and becomes a core coordinating notion for the rise of insurance from about the latter part of the 18th century onwards. The term risk then becomes a secularized part of ordinary economic discourse. For a long time remained relatively confined to that. In the 20th century, the term risk starts to be used all over the place in many, many different kinds of contexts. Now, the Middle Ages didn't have a notion of risk. Why not? Because you could say, well, everybody faces risk, don't they? To understand that, I think you have to understand the difference between risk and hazard, or risk and danger. Risk is not the same as hazard. Risk is not the same as danger. To put things crudely, you only need a concept of risk when you seek to actively organize the kind of society, indeed, that Marx thought could be radicalized, a society oriented towards the future, in which there is an attempt to control the future as a sort of territory into which one can effectively march. The simplest definition of risk, I think, is that risk refers to any activity, current or projected, which might have adverse or unwanted consequences. Risk refers to the chance of adverse consequences following from a particular course of action. The reason why the term risk only becomes used with a transition from the Middle Ages is that the world is no longer then experienced as a natural and given phenomenon. Hazards, dangers, they come from anywhere. They come from God, they come from the experienced outer world. They become risks when you seek to take a more active, future-oriented relation to them. What's important about this, I think, is that the notion of risk may have originated as a geographical notion, but for me, the idea of risk is first of all about the future, and more generally all about time and control of time. Of course, it's about control of space too, as modernity seeks to conquer time and space, but the notion of risk intrinsically is about control of time. I mean, Keynes understood that, I think, when he wrote about money and time and its relationship to risk, and some other economists have written interestingly on it. But it's generalizable. Risk is a notion associated with an active orientation towards future time, in which there is an attempt to actually control one's orientation towards a recognizable and consciously determined future. Now, the idea of risk, the emergence of the idea of risk, is coeval with the emergence of the idea of insurance. And this is also really interesting, I think. I mean, the idea of insurance sounds incredibly boring, but it isn't when you pursue it, because I think you can say that the rise of insurance is probably as much a part of modernity, the rise of modernity, as the rise of any straightforwardly productive industrial sector. Because what is insurance? Well, insurance is also an attempt to control future time, and a control attempt to normalize hazard in relation to that future time. In many countries in the world today, where many dangers are still experienced as hazards rather than as risks, you can't get insurance for many things we just assume you can get insurance for. We simply assume, I think, now you can get insured for almost everything. But it's a strange situation, historically strange situation. If you just experience the world as fate, if simply things happen to you, you fall ill or you have an accident or you lose all your money, if you experience the world as fate, you normalize that phenomenon in quite a different way from the way in which we do in our society. If you assume that everything could be insured, you assume that we can normalize what otherwise appears to come as something which is experienced as an independently given phenomenon. I'll come back to this in a subsequent lecture because it has a lot of resonant political implications. I presumably don't have to point out to most people here that the rise of the welfare state is very much connected with the generalization of the idea of insurance and risk management. I mean, risk management is ordinarily understood to be a kind of privatized financial market sort of notion, but the welfare state is all about risk management, and the welfare state is all about insurance mechanisms. The welfare state, in large part, arose, apart from its redistributive aspects across the classes, arose as an insurance system, but I don't think it's usually recognized as such. If you do recognize it as such, and if you also do, as I don't know whether you will, accept the argument they're going to propose to you as a shift in the nature of risk today, it would follow that debates about the welfare state must be oriented towards a shift in risk which influences the very nature of the concept of risk management, or I think it does anyway in current circumstances, in a way which I'll go on to emphasize.
Can I just ask, in antiquity, did they have a notion of risk in ancient times, the Romans?
Did they, you're saying? Well, that's disputed, as it's disputed whether peasants have it depends on sort of what translation you pick, really, so it's always arguable. But in all cultures, you have notions that kind of verge on it. And you do whenever you confront, I think, something like the same sort of circumstances, some need to orient yourself towards future time. So if you're a peasant, for example, you need to have some relationship to the next harvest and the next year. Mostly, however, anything that approaches the notion of risk is, in such systems, is either quasi-religious notion or is much closer to the notion of fate. So that's the more usual thing. In a sense, I think risk substitutes for fate, you see. Or at least I want to argue that. Shall I go on? Because I think if I stop too often, just don't cover the material. But I'm very happy if people ask questions, I must say, because it betrays a certain sort of keeping up with what I'm saying, and at least an attempt to interrogate me, which I think you certainly should do. So anyway, and I'll stop if anyone else does say something or show some sign of movement anywhere in the room. Oh dear, too much movement already. Could you speak up so that everyone else can hear you anyway? Or your question was whether the notion of risk arose with notion of pessimism.
Capitalism.
Oh, capitalism. Oh. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was normalized by the rise of capitalism, really, if you interpret that as the economic system of modernity, as I would. That, obviously, because, you know, in capitalism, you must normalize time. I mean, I didn't talk about this in relation to Max Weber. This is one of Max Weber's strongest themes, you know. What made a difference between modern capitalism and other forms of capitalism is that modern capitalism, you have a regular relationship with time. That is, you normalize your profit and investment in such a way that you can regularize it across time as well as space. Traditional forms of capital adventurism and so forth, mercantile capitalism, didn't do that. So, yes, very much so. And I hope that everyone recognizes that the notion of risk has, as it were, two sides to it. And I wasn't going to talk about this much, but I mean, notion of risk is a wonderful notion for reflecting on our lives and our society. I mean, I find anyway, and there are lots of nuances to it, but there is, as it were, a positive side to risk and a negative side to risk. I mean, risk, I think, always presumes the possibility of a negative outcome. That is, it has that negative connotation to it, the chance of a negative outcome. But there are two sort of contexts of risk which are important for us. One is positive. That is, if you accept risk, you can receive reward. Capitalism is very much based on an institutionalization of that. But so are other aspects of our lives too. Everybody knows that the positive embrace of risk can be life-enhancing. I mean, you know, it can knock you off the mountain, but you get a lot of sort of feeling of elation when you get to the top of the mountain, too. The embracing of risk is very much part of the rise of modernity, in that sense, it's part of its kind of innovative nature, I think. If I get a chance, I might talk of this book called The High Risk Society, which an economist just wrote that influenced me quite a bit about what's happening in modern capitalism. But whether I get time, I don't know. But the negative side of risk is risk seen in the context of its suboptimal consequences. Not only that things can go wrong, but that the things can go wrong side of risk becomes a kind of dominant part of one's orientation to the world. And for example, the ecological debate is very much centered on the if I can call it that, negative side of risk. And you find in the current literature on risk two very different views. Peter Bernstein's book, Against the Gods, A Remarkable Story of Risk, if you want to read that, very much treats risk as a positive thing, the embracing of risk, and locates it in the emergence of capitalistic markets. And now, something everyone should take an interest in, futures markets, derivatives markets, they're all risk folded on risk, you know. They're all a way of organizing the future, really. Sort of making profit out of the future, anyway, conception of the future. Ecological debates very much dominated by the other kind of mood feeling about risk, high consequence risk for the planet, and so forth and so forth. Notion of risk reflects these two sides of our lives, I think. Anyway, my argument so far is that risk is distinct from hazard, that the notion of risk tends to arise in a society which is oriented towards the future. The notion of risk intrinsically presumes that kind of society, but also, I must say, it presumes that kind of person. In the next lecture next week, I'm going to talk about the effects of changes on our personal lives, on emotional life, and the self. All these things are reflected in those domains as well. Here we're talking about the long-term evolution of modernity, however. The long-term evolution of modernity, the notion of risk fitted in with the idea of a controllable future, whether you invest in it positively, like a capitalist stance, or whether you try to control the various dangers which humankind faces. Now, I want to propose to you that in the current era, and this only goes back about 30 or 40 years or so, the period that, roughly speaking, people don't like the term, but I tend to call late modernity, whatever you call it, a period of globalization that I discussed last time, a period dominated by the globalization of capitalism and the globalization of a business-oriented society, dominated by global market forces. Over that period, we're experiencing a transition in forms of uncertainty and forms of risk, which shift us away from the theorems which the Enlightenment thinkers, insurance agents, and business personnel tended to use the notion of risk to conform to. It's a shift in our experience of risk, a shift in our experience of uncertainty. Now, many economists from Frank Knight onwards make a distinction between risk and uncertainty. Personally, I don't find that distinction a sustainable one. In any case, I don't propose to use it. So in this lecture, I'll just use the term risk and uncertainty as more or less synonymous. I want to propose to you that we're living through an era of transition from what I call external risk or external uncertainty to an era of created or manufactured risk or manufactured uncertainty. Let me explain the difference between those two. External risk is risk which is still distinct from hazard, but where you normalize hazard by supposing that the sources of risk are outside of human action and control, or at least can be treated statistically as though they were outside. The clearest example of external risk is the experience of external nature. For hundreds of years, I think, as I mentioned briefly in a previous lecture, I think you can say that human beings worried about the threats, the hazards from external nature. When the notion of risk arose, these became understood as insurable risks coming from external nature. Threats of plague, threats of famine, threats of floods, threats of bad harvests, and so on. I would like to at least lodge the claim with you that the dominance of external risk reflected a world of largely taken for granted external nature, where nature was still experienced as a source of accepted hazards which one could control primarily by statistical means. You control the hazards primarily by insuring against those hazards through developing actuarial series whereby you can predict their occurrence and recompense people who suffer from the negative side of natural occurrences. External risk, I want to say, however, also reflected a society where custom, tradition, and habit were still largely intact. And I'd like to suggest anyway that nature and tradition, until relatively recently, even with all the advances of the early development of modernity, still provided, as it were, relatively fixed landscapes for our activities, at least in many aspects of our lives. Insofar as tradition still remained a significant part of people's lives, insofar as nature still remained something largely outside our activities, you can speak of a culture or society dominated by external risk or external uncertainty. Over the last 30 or 40 years, we're experiencing a major shift towards the advent of what I'm going to call manufactured uncertainty or manufactured risk. Manufactured uncertainty is uncertainty created by the very advance of human knowledge and by the very intensity of the application globally of science and technology to the external world and to the world of the human body. I don't like too much all this talk of endings, but if I can sort of use a couple of endings anyway, you could call this, this is a period marked by what Bill McKibben calls the end of nature. The end of nature is, of course, not the end of processes in nature outside of our control, not at all. The end of nature means the end of a period in which nature is largely experienced and exists as independently of most of the things that human beings do. At some point, and I think it's fairly relatively recent, we started worrying less about what nature can do to us and more about what we've done to nature, especially in Western countries. When you make that transition, making a transition, I want to argue, from the dominance of external risk or uncertainty to the dominance of manufactured risk or manufactured uncertainty. Now, a key part of my argument is this applies to social life itself. The accumulation of knowledge about ourselves, the accumulation of knowledge of our own history, of our own society, other people's societies, and so on, rather than creating a secure future into which we can march, actually, at the same time as it creates certain securities for us, expands the realm of manufactured uncertainty. I'll be arguing in the next lecture that this intrudes deeply into the self, into the body, into our emotions, and into our personal relationships. Living in a world of manufactured uncertainty, or where manufactured uncertainty has become the prevalent type of uncertainty or risk, just feels and is very different from living in a world dominated by external risk. It shifts our relationship to science and technology. It shifts our relationship to other institutions, but it also shifts the mechanics of self-identity, of what we are as human beings and how we relate to our bodies. Now, a key part of the end of nature, as I would see it, is the end of nature in the body. We're not just talking here about the external world being increasingly penetrated, for better or for worse, by human science and technology and human invention. We're talking also of the human body. The human body was always cosseted, cultivated, adorned, trained, disciplined. Of course, we know this in all cultures. But again, relatively recently, with the kind of increasing intensity of scientific and technological innovation, you can say that science and technology increasingly invade the body and transform it. The same thing is also true of lifestyle practices. With the relapse of custom and tradition, the body is no longer taken for granted in the way in which it used to be. Not even its sexual identity, its physical sexual identity is taken for granted simply and purely in the way in which it used to be. To be people who simply don't have bodies which we train, adorn, and so forth, but where the body becomes something that has to be actively confronted every day of our lives as a mobile phenomenon, where science and technology and the knowledge systems produced by them are constantly in contact with those in relation to what we eat, what we drink, how much exercise we take, what projections we make of our future health, and so forth, this is again a very new world, I think. And I want to introduce, oh dear, lecture slipping away, but I want to introduce some concepts to help us understand this. So the spread of manufactured uncertainty is a key part of what I'm saying, what I'm arguing. It's an expression of the problems of enlightenment. You can't escape from enlightenment, you cannot escape from science and technology. To me, there can be no retreat into new world cosmology or anything outside of these phenomena. Simply, we're in a much more dialectical, interrogatory relationship to the diversity of knowledge sources which we're surrounded with in a society increasingly dominated by manufactured risk or manufactured uncertainty. One way of charting out this transition is the mundane way of looking at the difficulties of insurance companies. Insurance companies in a world dominated by external risk can employ quite accurate actuarial methods of measuring risk. the more manufactured uncertainty comes along, the more we're living in knowledge environments where past history isn't much of a guide, and where therefore you can't use usually the same kind of actuarial methods that insurance companies have traditionally used to assess risk in these circumstances. Right the way through from the risk of getting divorced, from the risks associated with global warming, from the risks associated with eating certain kinds of foods, most of these risk phenomena are now in a different knowledge environment whose characteristics I now want to go on to inquire into. Now, the driving force behind transition from the dominance of external uncertainty, the dominance of manufactured uncertainty, is the global expansion of market-oriented capitalism in conjunction with other globalizing forces, which I discussed in the last lecture at the end of last term. I'm not in this lecture discussing those dynamics, which are complex but very interesting and important. I just simply remind you of my argument, which is that we're living through a period of intense globalization. Globalization, however, is not to be understood primarily as just the expansion of economic markets taken per se. It's actually a shift in the way in which we live. It's a shift as much in our local and personal lives as it is in the larger systems which envelop us and to which we respond. The emergence of a global cosmopolitan society based upon the intensification of science, technology, and intensification of time in general is simply a different environment, social environment, in which we now find ourselves. Now, I'd suggest there are three sort of basic characteristics of this world which are of interest to social scientists and which are certainly relevant to the two last lectures I plan to give, the one on personal life and last one on politics and implications for political programs and how we might relate to this world. Incidentally, could I make it clear that I'm not arguing that the world is more uncertain or risky than it used to be? You cannot, I think, say that, and I don't know what the evidence for that would be. My argument is that the form and nature of risk is changing, and coupled to that, that we all operate with a notion of risk much more constantly, much more fundamentally than ever before, without necessarily realizing it. There are reasons for this which I'll come on to later, but all of us now, a lot of the time, in some way or another, operate in our personal lives as well as our collective futures with the idea of risk, with the concept of risk. Insofar as this becomes manufactured risk or manufactured uncertainty, it marks off a society which does not come to terms with its history in the way in which Marx anticipated that it would. Living in a society suffused with manufactured risk is a puzzling experience. It's a society oriented towards the future more strongly than any society previously, but where this orientation to the future produces as much uncertainty as certainty about what that future will be, and where, moreover, constant announcements about where what the future will be regularly influence and shape that future. This is what our world is like. There is no future for us. There are only future scenarios in every area of life in which we care to think. Whether it be a decision to live with somebody, whether it be a decision to build a nuclear power station, whether it be a decision to try to produce a market society in the Soviet Union, nearly all future-orienting thinking is scenario thinking, where you recognize in those scenarios that those scenarios influence what the very scenarios themselves describe. Futures and derivatives markets are a formal attempt to cope with that kind of complex and, in the end, in a sense, impenetrable relationship to the future which we've constructed to ourselves. I mean, in case this isn't obvious, I think a lot of reflection on contemporary society comes down to reflections about time and space, where these are understood not as physical concepts but as socially organizing concepts for how we live our lives, again, whether you're talking individually or collectively. What are the three things happening? Well, how do one conceptualize these things? The first is one I've already alluded to. We're living, I think, in an era which you could roughly call the end of nature. I mean, there are objections you could make to that phrase. Among the areas of the end of nature are particularly important and interesting, I'll come back to in the next lecture next Tuesday, the end of nature in the body that I've previously described. I want to argue that, for example, the rise of eating disorders, the rise of anorexia in Western society, quite amazing phenomenon of pathology of the body, is directly involved with these changes, a kind of one way of exemplifying, but there are lots of others as well. The end of nature in the body means that we simply don't have bodies in the sense in which you could argue human beings did previously. And a lot of interesting things. Again, I should stress, many of these things have very mundane consequences. If you ask about healthcare reform, you ask about the future of the welfare state, even though these reflections sound abstract and maybe off-putting, I believe they're very relevant to quite a lot of mundane policy issues when you pursue them to the end, because the welfare state, for example, was constructed as a system of external risk. It was constructed against the background of that, where you assume that certain things happen to you and the welfare state steps in to protect you. Welfare state systems don't, and I think can't, have the same form in an era of manufactured risk or manufactured uncertainty, where an active orientation towards the future in a complex knowledge environment is simply part of everybody's lives, and you can't any longer react to that as though it were a system of external risk. To me, quite a lot of the troubles of the welfare state don't simply come from the fact that people can't pay for it or won't pay for it, but from the fact that it demands a different system of risk management from the one around which it was originally constructed. In that sense, it mirrors the problems of private insurance. Private insurance companies are struggling. I mentioned a bit earlier with the same kind of problems. The phenomenon of the end of nature is essentially a social phenomenon. And I must say, sort of digressing onto parochial things, it doesn't seem to me, unless I've missed it, that in the LSE there is enough discussion of ecological issues. I haven't sort of found it here so far, but to me the ecological crisis in a way is the crisis of the late 20th century. If you define it, not as a crisis, I think, of resources, not even as a crisis of pollution, but as a crisis of how we live in relation to the external physical world, when that physical world is no longer nature. When it is no longer nature, or when nature means something different, when we have to reflect on what nature can possibly mean, when you go into a supermarket and every other product is marked natural, when the very signifier nature and natural shift their meaning, again, it's a different sort of texture of experience involved, and I take it the ecological issues center upon that. What it's like, how we should live after the end of nature, not just in relation to ourselves, but in relation to other species as well. An awful lot could be said about that. The second thing going on, I want to argue, you can roughly call the end of tradition, the dissolution of tradition as it was traditionally lived. Now, modernity was always hostile to tradition. The point of Marx was to overcome tradition. But it's truer to say that what happened instead, that for a couple of hundred years at least, there was a sort of symbiosis between modernity and tradition. This was in part a kind of collaborative bargain between the public and private spaces of modernity. Many of the public spaces, especially in the economy above all, but to some degree in politics, were detraditionalized, opened up to discursive debate, and oriented towards a risk-infused, future-oriented system. This did not apply to many areas of personal life, to marriage, to the family, to patriarchal power. There are many elements, I mean, this is very crudely put, but many elements of modernity which remain traditionalized, where custom tradition retained their hold. This was, of course, also true to some degree of the more public domains as well. largely because of intensifying globalization, but not wholly because of that, we live in an era of radical detraditionalization, where detraditionalization applies not only to the public sphere, but to the private one as well, and where the detraditionalization of the private sphere is resonant with consequences for the public sphere also. What does detraditionalization mean? Well, it doesn't mean as such the disappearance of tradition. I don't have time, unfortunately, in this lecture to say what I mean by tradition, but I think I have a clear conceptualization of it. Very, very briefly, tradition is a form of collective memory protected by ritual, where that ritual defends a practical truth claim that cannot be discursively redeemed, where you have to act out that truth claim. Tradition is collective, tradition is ritualistic, tradition is resistant to the discourse of modernity, to the fact that your discourse of modernity means, you know, discuss it, reason about it, study it. Tradition isn't like that. Tradition, I think, in Western countries, but to some degree across the world, in an era of globalization, becomes dissolved into several competing components, none of which really resemble tradition as traditionally understood. Tradition either becomes kitsch, it becomes the little metal Eiffel Tower that you buy in Paris airport, or tradition becomes heritage. Heritage is a manufactured past, which in some sense you encounter in the museum or you encounter in the heritage park itself. Or tradition becomes something selectively embraced, something chosen. This is the case with the born-again Christian, for example. Born-again Christian is someone who chooses a tradition. Tradition is never chosen when it is tradition as tradition, I think. Or, more worryingly, the other alternative, tradition tends to relapse into fundamentalism. I'd like at least to propose to you that in an era of globalization, detraditionalization is marked by the rise of fundamentalism. Fundamentalism is not a notion which has always existed. Fundamentalism is, as it were, purified, modernized, radicalized defense of tradition in a world where tradition is embattled by discourse. It's a kind of symbiotic defense of tradition which attempts to purify the past in order to confront a much more cosmopolitan present. I'd like at least to propose to you that fundamentalism can exist in any domain which is being evacuated from tradition, or where tradition is under threat. So that you should understand by fundamentalism not any particular content of belief, but a form of assertion about a belief or a set of moral claims. Fundamentalism, I think, is not anything that has any specific content. It is a mode of argument and practice. You can therefore speak, I think, not only of religious fundamentalism, not only of ethnic fundamentalism, not only of nationalist fundamentalisms, but, for example, of gender fundamentalism. A man, for example, who refuses to talk about himself and resorts to simple assertion in a marriage or relationship, and perhaps resorts to violence, to me would be an example of a fundamentalist-style assertion. And I think a good deal of violence against women actually stems from this fundamentalist-style assertion. Negatively, then, you can define fundamentalism, I think, certainly if you don't look at its interesting, attractive features, of which it does have some, I think, as a refusal of dialogue, because we live in a world which insists upon dialogue. Detraditionalization means essentially opening up things to dialogue, so or opening up things to discussion and public understanding. So that, for example, gender identity was for a long while fixed by the body and by tradition, but now gender identity is an open phenomenon which in some sense not only do we discuss, but you must discuss. I mean, to live in a world of manufactured uncertainty is a world where you must in some sense face up to questions which were once encapsulated within nature or encapsulated within tradition. If I get time next time, I'll be saying the rise of addiction, the rise of obsession, the rise of a kind of obsessional culture is the other side of the transformation of tradition. It's a sort of way, but an uncontrolled, anxiety-infused way of living in a repetitive fashion. Tradition always allowed us to live repetitively. But you can't simply live repetitively in a world which often asks you questions all the time and expects some answers from you. These are practical questions. Practical answers are the ones you have to provide. The transformation of tradition, by the way, makes itself felt in public domain as well. I mean, if you ask what's happening to political discourse, political change, the collapse of deference in politics, the collapse of traditional symbolism, the rise of corruption cases worldwide, these are all aspects of the detraditionalization of politics, I think, crudely put anyway. I mean, all these things have a much more complex and subtle resonance to them if discussed in more detail. I won't stop if you don't mind, there's only 2 minutes left, but happy to talk to you directly afterwards. Finally, a society living after the end of nature, a society living after the end of tradition, is also society, I propose to you, of intensified reflexivity. Reflexivity is our everyday mode of coping with, reacting to, but also reconstituting a world of manufactured uncertainty or manufactured risk. What is reflexivity? Reflexivity is not increasing self-consciousness, not primarily that. Reflexivity means how you live in a world of many information sources to which not only must you respond, but where that response becomes constitutive of what your actions are. In an increasingly knowledge-infused, complex knowledge environment, you must engage with the sources of incoming knowledge. You have no option but to, in some sense or another. There is that reflexive engagement. But that engagement at the same time reconstitutes not only your own actions, but to some extent the environment of other people. A world of intensified reflexivity is therefore intrinsically, I think, in fundamental way, an erratic world. The rise of reflexivity is both a signal and a contributory factor to the disappearance of the future. Disappearance of the future is itself a concrete expression of living in an intensifying reflexive environment. Now, reflexivity, the development of social reflexivity as it tends to replace tradition, like all of these changes, has positive and negative side to it. Living in a more reflexive world is emancipatory because it is a world open to discourse where, if I can put it this way, there can be and there is endless talk about everything. That is the style of our world. On the other hand, a world of endless reflexivity is immensely disturbing. You can't live along with it all the time. You must situate yourself in relation to it. How do people situate themselves in relation to it? Well, how they do it, how we all do it, is we all develop fixed lifestyle habits of one form or another. These fixed lifestyle habits, however, don't have the same, or normally don't have the same kind of moral underpinning they did in a more traditionalized culture. Therefore, when you go through a crisis in your life, when someone leaves you, get divorced, you lose your job, it's often an enveloping crisis because it places in question the lifestyle habits and practices which help constitute yourself. The only way in which we secure identity in a reflexive society is itself reflexively. You have a reflexive engagement to self, which is part and parcel of developing a certain stable lifestyle orientation. But that lifestyle orientation is brittle. On the other side of it is obsessiveness. I hope that everyone, I don't know whether you accept this or not, but to me it's a really interesting thing. To have a life now, in the ordinary sense in which it is said, get a life, you must have stable lifestyle habits. But stable lifestyle habits are always on the edge of obsessiveness. Always on the edge of addiction. The rise of addictions is the other side of the need to stabilize lifestyle practices without a traditional undergirding to do so. There won't be anyone in this room who doesn't have some kind of obsessive edge, whether it's with work, with exercise, or with other preoccupations that constitute the stuff of day-to-day life. So more of this on next Tuesday. Thanks very much for coming. Very nice of you.